Take your Bibles and let's start in chapter 11. We're going to look here at the Tower of Babel, and I'm going to turn to Genesis 11 as well because we have another genealogy, and you should have with your bulletin some handouts that will kind of help keep us all on the same page. And I'm going to try and find a map for you that's has the tower of the table of nations superimposed over the current nationalities, the current places. But I was looking this morning a little bit before church, and I wasn't able to really find what I was looking for. But in verses 1 through 4 here, what we find is the people congregating and collecting themselves as opposed to doing what God wanted them to do, which was be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it. So, verse 1, and it was the all the world was one language, one lip. All the people on the planet had one language and one set of words. United States of America, English has tons of words. We steal words from everybody. If you're ever trying to learn a foreign language, you always appreciate it if the language that you're trying to learn doesn't have the kind of vocabulary that English has. But, you know, we find words and we like that and we incorporate it into us. But at this time of the world, everybody, the whole world, had only one language and one set of words for everything. And it was in their traveling along from the east, they found a plain. So starting on the Ararat mountain range, as one, still one group of people. Remember, chapter 10 comes after chapter 11. That's not how we have it listed in our Bible, but in the development of Genesis, the effect is put first, and the cause is what we're dealing with now. So the three sons of Noah, their wives, and they all started journeying, going from the where the ark landed towards the east, and we're looking here at five generations. We don't know the exact date of the Tower of Babel. It's not given to us in Scripture, so we aren't really sure. But you know, we're all within 50 or 75 years of each other in the dating, but the common range is from 2206 to 2242. I think I said 2243, but then I counted a 30-year generation. It's five generations after the ark landed. So it's not a great amount of time, but in five generations, when people are having kids starting at 35 or 40, and they're living 100 years, 150 years, even some of them 200, you're going to have a lot of children in that time period. You say, well, they had their children, you know, 40 or 50 years apart. That's not the case. We know, for instance, that Noah's oldest son was born when he was 500 years old, when Noah was the son of 500 years, and that Shem was born 2 years after that. We'll see that as we go through this passage in the genealogies. But they're journeying from the mountain region, and they find a plain, a flat plain. Now, part of what we think about here is that we look at the region of Babylon today, and it's a God-forsaken desert, right? I mean, we know more about Iraq than any other generation because of the wars that we've fought over there. But it may not have been like that when this account is being given. There was a cataclysmic disruption in Genesis 19 with Sodom and Gomorrah, and that whole area changed. Before that, the text says it was like the Garden of Eden. So this may have been a very verdant, fruitful area, and it's on a plain in the area of Babylon. And that's where they dwelt there, verse 2. So they came to a plain, a flat open area in the land of Shinar, which is Babylon. and they dwelt there. That's where they settled down. So in verse 3, we find the decision-making process that's going on. And each man said to his neighbor, come, let's all get together. Let's make bricks, sun-dried bricks, and bake them thoroughly. And there was to them lots of bricks. They made lots of bricks, and they used them like stones. They were like stone for them. And the tar was there for them to use for mortar. Now, in our previous discussions about Genesis 6, we understood that Noah was to take tar and put it. It's a different term. So my guess is, looking backwards, and a lot of times scripture is like a jigsaw puzzle, you put little pieces together. My guess is that what Noah was using was like pitch, not tar. The sealant that he used would have been like tree sap, a form of that, whereas this is more like the tar. And we'll see that this is the same term that's used in Genesis 14 with five kings against four, and they fell into the tar pit. So they're using this tar for mortar, and they're building a building. So verse 4, and they said, come, this is an imperative to each person that's singular all the way through here. Interestingly, each man's talking to his neighbor, and here you all come. We would say you all come, but it's each person come and let us build up for ourselves a city and a tower. So they're gonna build a tower. They've had enough of living in tents. Hate tents, but you know, they're gonna build a city so they don't have to keep moving, and a tower, the head of it into the heavens. So a tall tower. And we'll make a name for ourselves, lest we are dispersed across the face of all the earth. So the dispersion here, there's three terms that are used that are distinct here about the dispersion. This one means to scatter, like you would scatter seeds. When we talk about Peleg and how the earth was scattered or divided in his term, in his days, that term is used in Job of a river coming down and separating land from one land on one side and one land of the river separates it. That's the one that's used in Peleg when the earth was divided. So it's possible that you have a couple of things that are happening at the same time here in Genesis 11. But they don't want to be scattered. They want to stay in one place. So the command that God gave them was to fill the earth, subdue it, multiply. And what they did was congregate. They collected themselves, built a city. And now the question that I had in my mind is, why is it important to God that the people should spread out and fill the continent? Why did they need to expand? And I don't know. The scripture doesn't give us the answer to that question, but you know, I still like to ask the questions. Some things that popped into my mind was that, well, if you have less people, you have less crime, right? You know, where are your crime-ridden areas? Well, it's the center of cities. I did a lecture some years ago on a look at American violence from the Old Testament. And the fellow wrote a book about American violence. And his findings were really startling, that you had a better chance of reaching your 43rd birthday living in Bangladesh than in living in Harlem, New York. These kinds of statistics. And he looked at American violence on the frontier, not even counting the violence that was done to Native Americans and Indians, just among the settlers. And the carnage was incredible. I mean, we are a violent nation. And he looked at all the different aspects of that. you know, the one on the tombstones, he called Bill Smith a liar and so forth, and compared and contrasted that with other nations. And so, you know, one of the things that I found interesting was that there's a couple of things that a young man can do to lengthen his life, okay? Just if you want to live longer as a young man, what you should do is get married and go to church and drive more safely. leave alcohol out of it. That was the conclusion of the book. But you know, when you start talking about unmarried, unchurched, alcohol-driven young men congregating in a central place, the crime rate just goes through the roof. It's, as you know. So less people equals less sin. Also, less people means more work, more hard work. You have to work a lot harder if you're in a rural area. If you want to eat, then you have to what? Have to work. The more people you have, the less opportunity for planting and so forth. And remember, part of what God did to prevent himself from having to destroy the world by a flood again was to shorten the lifespan of people. And they were going to be planting and harvesting hard work rather than just being able to eat whatever they find. And also, if you have areas that are uninhabited, what takes over that area? Wild animals. So if you have large sections now after the flood that are uninhabited by people, humans are supposed to subdue the earth. That means taking and reducing the number of animals that will kill your children. America hasn't quite figured this out. We're reintroducing animals that our forefathers killed so that their children could walk safely to school. And we think it's a good thing to introduce these animals back so that our grandchildren can be eaten by them. Crazy, crazy way of looking at humans as if we are part of the animal kingdom rather than to subdue them. And you know, one of the things that I pointed out is that Nimrod was a great hunter before the Lord. And while I think that includes the oppression of peoples and conquering areas as a warrior, it also certainly includes the hunting and destroying of animals. Any of you all hunters here? Okay, several of you. I'm terrible at it. I just, you know, I tried to do this with my kids. I'm not bad at fishing, but hunting. You know, so my boys, they really like to hunt, and so I started buying guns, and, you know, I always tried to buy a gun that would impress them. I don't think I ever succeeded in that. But my way of hunting was I told the Lord, okay, if you want me to shoot a deer, you got 10 minutes. I drove my 4Runner over to a meadow, and I parked it there. So it's like, hey, Lord, the clock's on. You want me to shoot something, it's got to come now, 10 minutes. Of course, my 4Runner probably scared it all off since the muffler didn't work. But that's my idea of hunting. If I had to live off of what I could hunt, we would all be much thinner. But Nimrod was a conqueror of these wild animals and made a name for himself as that, and I think it extended to other things. So anyway, the people had one language, one set of words, and they decided that what they would do is congregate and build this city. Now, you may read a lot about ziggurats and the kind of worship, and that's probably true. There's a fellow who wrote a book called The Two Babylons, and starts from the Tower of Babel, and he builds the case for a historical mother-child cult that actually traversed through all of the different languages and cultures because of the Tower of Babel. So throughout the world you have mother-child cult, and then he traces going forward. There's actually two books out this. Comes back at the end of eschatology, where everything comes back to Babel or Babylon again with a final world religion. and he traces how it moved to Pergamos and then to Rome, and then goes back from Rome in the future to Babylon, which is the headquarters of the Antichrist. And of course, Antichrist moves it all to Jerusalem when Babylon is destroyed. You can read about that in Revelation. But the point of this passage hasn't to do with the future. It has to do with the past. And it's giving to the nation of Israel a groundwork for why there are so many different languages and where these 71 people groups came from, Genesis 10. And each of them has a different language. So in verse 5 and 6, we find that God doesn't like the direction humans are taking. Verse 5, "And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of Adam built." Kind of a real interesting way of looking at this. So coming down, I believe he's referring to heaven. So the Lord came down to see what's going on. And again, all kinds of really interesting questions are coming to my mind about this. Why does he have to go down and see it? It may be a pre-incarnate appearance of Christ, probably is. But he comes down to see how things are going. And, you know, it occurred to me that the Lord, in these early chapters, creates and builds and does, and then lets things go to see how it's going to go. And so he creates man and puts him in the region and gives him one prohibition, and you know the story. And then he breaks them out of the Garden of Eden and bars their return so they can't get to the Tree of Life. And then it goes forward, and you come to Genesis 6, where God was really sorry that he'd made humans and the flood and so forth. Well, here again you have Christ coming down to see the city and the tower which the sons of Adam had built. But I think what God seems to do, at least in these early chapters and in some way with us, he gives us a lot of freedom to do things, to see what we're going to do and how we're going to do it and why we're going to do it. When I was a kid, my dad was a carpenter, and that meant I had access to tools, I had access to wood, had access to glue, had access to nails. You know, I still remember getting into trouble because I had a coffee can of nails that I was using, and I left it outside. And one of the four times it rained every year in Arizona, it rained, and my dad brought me this rusted mess of nails and said, "Look what happened when you left it out." Well, of course I left it out. I was building. But we had pet shops. We don't have pet shops anymore. But if you had a couple of dollars, you could go down the street to a pet shop and buy an animal. It was great fun. I had probably one of everything, but I'd have to build a cage for it. So, you know, I'd go buy a guinea pig, and then I'd build a cage for it. It was a lot of fun. You know, they were really pretty ugly cages, but they worked. I learned inductively that guinea pigs don't do ladders. They just... You know, I built this really cool top part where it could go up there, and it couldn't get up the ladder. So then I built a ramp, and it didn't do ramps. Guinea pigs pretty much sit there and squeak. But, you know, mice do ladders great. Hamsters do. You know, but you'd buy these animals, and then you'd build stuff for it to see how it would respond to it. And it looks like what's going on here is that God gives us a tremendous amount of freedom and latitude. And he's interested to see how it's going. In this case, he comes down and he doesn't like what he finds. My hope always is that should Christ appear tangibly, literally, at our church and our school, that he would find us honoring him, worshiping, serving, that what we're doing and why we're doing it is honoring to the Lord. That should be our hope, I think. Verse 6, and this is, again, this is really cool. "And the Lord said," I suppose, look at the logic here. The Lord said, you know, what if, and it's I suppose would be a good way to translate. I suppose the people are one, And the language, the lip is one for all of them. You know, he looks at this and he says, what in the world? This isn't what I told them to do. But, you know, I suppose since they're one language and one group, and this is what they're beginning to do, this is what they're making. So instead of doing what the Lord wanted them to do, they're doing this. And now it will not be impossible for them all to do whatever they want. Whatever purpose they come up with, they're going to accomplish. You know, they're going to put people on the moon. How we did that. It's going to be impossible. Whatever this group of people, one group, one language, decides to do, they're going to be able to do it. So you have this coming down, and you have an observation, and then I suppose that Christ went back up to heaven, and there's this divine council, and a decision is made. Verse 7, this is the council here, and they're going to bring an end to the project. Let us, notice the plurality here, it's a good place to argue for the Trinity. Let us come down and let us confuse there at that place the language, their language, their lip. And they will not hear a man's language of his neighbor. So we're going to go down and we're going to confuse their languages. And the Lord scattered them from there. So he went down and he confused all the languages. This is actually a great, great place to argue against evolution as well. The way God did this is just incredibly masterful and marvelous. And based on chapter 10, the 71 nations, each man according to his language. And when he changed these languages, he didn't just change them a little bit. You know, you have languages that are in the same family. We have some people who speak Spanish, and they're able to understand someone who speaks in French. There's overlap, especially if they're in the southern part of France where they pronounce the words in the northern part of France. They have a shorthand version of French, which they don't pronounce any of the last syllables. They speak French in Burundi. But when I went there and I introduced myself the first time in French, I looked out there and nobody understood a word I said. And I found out the reason for that is the only people who speak French are actually the ones who are working for the government. Everybody else speaks Kurundi. But these different languages are radically, radically different. Not just the word set, but the thought process and the structure of the language. So, you know, the Semitic languages, you have the verb coming first and the things going after it, you know. And it's you go down into the African language groups, and I can't even read Kurundi. You know, I've been there now more than a dozen times, and I'm able to take the Kurundi Bible finally after all those years and compare and contrast and find out, you know, what is your text actually saying? And that's real helpful when you come across a problem in translation to be able to see what it is. When I was in Ukraine, we had this big discussion. Far east, it's now Russia, but far east Ukraine, the pastors were saying women shouldn't wear pants, meaning trousers. And I said, no, 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 no. No, 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 no. Yes, yes, that's what the Bible says. No, 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 it doesn't. Yes, it does. So, you know, we got out their Russian Bible, and the translator had translated the word effeminate in the Old Testament, don't wear pants for a woman. So he was using a cultural explanation of the text. So, you know, we sat down and explained that there's masculine and there's feminine. and men are to be masculine and women are to be feminine, but that's a cultural thing. You know, so but the differences in the languages really have no explanation other than this. This is the only thing that makes sense of the history and what we're actually experiencing. So from there, they were scattered. They didn't want to be scattered, spread abroad, but they were. The Lord scattered them from there over the face of all the earth, and they stopped building the city. Verse 9 is the conclusion of this. Because of this, the place of it is called Babel, because there the Lord confused, and Babel and confusion are cognates. They're the same root word. So it's called confusion. It's called Babel, because the Lord confused the lip of all the earth, and from there the Lord caused the scattering over the face of all the earth. So in these early parts here of chapter 11, we find that God stopped what they were doing, and the way he did it was by giving them different languages. Now, I think this is hilarious. Can you imagine? I'm assuming it happened at night. But you get up, and your family, because it's each man according to his household, each language, and the tribe, there's that family group now speaks German. This family group speaks Kurundi. That family group speaks Russian. This family group speaks Hebrew. So you've got these different groups, and you go to work, and nobody can understand anything. Sarah and I were staying in a place in Ukraine, and she went with me on that trip, and it was a lot of fun. We stayed in an apartment. We slept in the living room. Well, actually, it's the common room, and we had a sofa sleeper that folded out, and you know, we spooned together. But if one of us had to turn over, then both of us had to turn over, because it was so small. But they had a little boy who had never met a foreigner. We were the first foreigners, and he thought we were the stupidest people on the planet. He brought his little toy. It was a little car, matchbox car, and he said Mashinka. And we didn't know what he was talking about. It's the only Russian word that stuck in my brain. Because by the time he was through, he was screaming at us, Mashinka. I think it means little small machine. You know, because we were playing together. Now they had another lad there who was actually old enough to, he was trying to learn English. And I was trying to learn Russian. So we worked together on it. And there are sounds in Russian. And I would say them. And he'd shake his head. I didn't get it. And I'd learned the Russian alphabet and had some lessons before we went. Because when I went to Poland, I couldn't even read the signs, the Cyrillic alphabet. So I'm never doing that again. There's no English anywhere. And I arrived 3 days after I was supposed to. Nobody's there in the airport to meet me. What do? You can't read anything. So I said, I'm never going back without at least being able to read something. So the older boy, you know, I would say the sound in Russian, and he'd shake his head, I didn't have it. And then in English, the boy threw the stick. Said, no, stick, stick. And he'd say, the boy threw the stick. Because they don't have that sound. So, you know, we'd go back and forth, and then we'd both laugh, because I couldn't hear the sound he was making in Russian, and he couldn't hear the sound I was making in English. Different languages. So God made it impossible for them to continue. So what you have now is a conclusion here. If you take out your Way Cool handout with the colors on it, you have the history of the sons of Noah, and this goes all the way through verse 9 of chapter 11. Confusion, dispersion, and the dispersion of the nations at Babel. And my best guess here is that God changed the language the people separated, and then God divided the continent. That's my best guess. And it happened someplace around 2240, 2250 BC, something like that. We don't have any dates. Now, the next section, the Toldot, is the history of Shem. That's 11, verse 10 through 26, and that'll take us all the way down to Abraham. And there's only a couple of comments that I want to make here. I'm sure you're glad of that. Let me look. This is the genealogy or the written history of Shem. Shem was 100 years old and begot Arphaxad 2 years after the flood. So based on this, we know that Noah was a son of 500 when he had Shem, Ham, and Japheth. That's according to Genesis 5:32, but that's not the order. Then in chapter 9, verse 24, Ham is said to be the younger, and then in 10:21, Shem is the father of Heber, and Japheth is the elder. And then here we find that Shem was 100 years old, 2 years after the flood. So the order of the people then is going to be of the sons is Japheth, Shem, and Ham. And I told you for obsessive compulsive people that I put out what David had put together on this, and I'm going to leave it out on the communion table afterwards. If you want to see the specifics of it, that's there. And while we're in this genealogy, I want to just make a comment that I've observed five different ways of putting these genealogies together. One way was Noah was a son of X number of years. And then you have another way of listing sons of, son of, son of. Then you have gave birth to, and then you have caused the birth of, and then was born. So there are ideas that these are all distinct and different and should be paid attention to. I couldn't see any differences. So I'm going to guess that at best it's a stylized issue so that you don't get bored while you read the genealogies if you're a Hebrew, but you're already bored. So I'm going to skip over that. Other than to note that these genealogies are laid out with no gaps. There's no gaps whatsoever. And while there is no word for grandson, interesting, there is a word for daughter-in-law, but there isn't a Hebrew word for grandson, it doesn't matter because it tells you the year of the person, what year they are when this person was born. So it's a tight genealogy, as I've given you in the handout with the color. And this goes all the way through this next section, all the way down to verse 26. And now Sarah lived 70 years and begot Abram, Nahor, and Haran. So you've gone now from Adam all the way down to Terah and Abraham. So that's this 20 generations of this handout. I've given you the main things, but you can see that they're now having children between 35 and 40. They're having children earlier, much earlier than before the flood. And that leads us to the next toldot, which is Genesis 11:27, and this goes forever. So what he's doing is breaking out the written histories of things that are important to come and focus upon Abraham, and this will take us all the way through chapter 25, which we aren't going to do. I want to go through Genesis 15 and then quit and go back to Hebrews. So that's been a year and a half since we've been in Hebrews, maybe longer. But if you look now at the next group that starts in verse 27, this is the genealogy of Terah. Terah begot Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Haran begot Lot, so we're already two generations down. And Haran died before his father, literally before the face of his father Terah, in his native land in Ur of the Chaldees. Now Ur of the Chaldees is actually on the Persian Gulf, you know, where Babylon is. You keep going in this day and time, it would have been on the Persian Gulf, all the way down there. And so that's where Ur of the Chaldees, or the Babylonians, is. Then Abraham and Nahor took wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai. Sarai is actually Abram's sister, stepsister. They had different mothers, but the same father. And the name of Nahor's wife was Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah and the father of Isaac. But Sarah was born and she had no child. So I've given you a little chart here of Abraham's, Terah's family. And interesting that the scriptures take it back to Terah, not to Abraham. And we'll look at some reasons why later. And Terah took his son Abram and his grandson Lot, the son of Haran, and his daughter-in-law Sarai, and the son Abram's wife, and they went out with them from Ur of the Chaldees to go to the land of Canaan, and they came to Haran and dwelt there. Now Haran is all the way up into the mountains at the headwaters of the Euphrates. So we're talking about from the Persian Gulf all the way as far as you can go before you have to turn south and come into the land of Canaan. So they go there and they dwell there, and the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. So they're headed, we'll see as we get into chapter 12, they're headed to the land of Canaan, which is actually the territory of Lot. And that's because God appeared to Abraham. And if I can talk my wife into it, I'll preach from Genesis 12 next Sunday during Easter. I'll bring in the gospel, you bring your friends, I'll get to the gospel in chapter 12, although Abraham doesn't actually become a believer until chapter 15. In 12, he still thinks that it's a co-op effort between him and God. All right, here's my application for you. In the living out of our lives, the Lord gives us great freedom. He wants to see what we're going to do with that freedom. He wants to see what we're going to do and how we're going to do it, and most importantly, why we're going to do it. So he gives us a lot of freedom with what we're going to do and how we're going to do it. But the why we're going to do it is where our rewards come from. So the why we should do what we're doing is because we love the Lord. And what's so cool about this is that that's internal, it's subjective. It allows people to earn rewards while they're being a homemaker. A homemaker taking care of children can earn more rewards with Christ than a pastor, because they can do it because they love Jesus. So my hope is that as God gives us the freedom to do what we want to do, and he gives us the freedom to how we do it, that our motivation for doing it will be to love the Lord.